Hello and welcome back to the Spiked podcast. I'm Fraser Myers, and with me as ever this week we have Spiked's editor Tom Slater.
Hello, Fraser.
And returning to the show, head of policy from MCC Brussels, it's Jacob Reynolds.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So we've got plenty to discuss today. First of all, we'll talk about the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, and his likely successful re-election bid. We'll talk about the fall of Hamza Yousaf, the brats at Columbia University, and finally, we'll talk about the migration crisis in Ireland. Now, quite exciting, Spiked is very, very close to hitting 100,000 subscribers. So if you haven't subscribed and you're watching right now, make sure you hit subscribe, click the bell, you'll never miss an episode. Now that the housekeeping is done, let's discuss Sadiq Khan. Tom, he's probably going to win by the time people watch this. We're recording this on the day of the vote, on the day of actually all of the local elections, but I suppose it's probably most in the bag for Sadiq Khan. He's basically declared, or his allies have declared, that anyone who doesn't vote for him, anyone who votes for Susan Hall, is enabling white supremacy, enabling racism, enabling Islamophobia. He's branded her the most dangerous candidate he's ever had to face in an election. What have you made of the sort of tenor of this election campaign?
Well, it's been really unhinged at the end there, hasn't it? I mean, I have been struck, which is why I think it's an interesting race to talk about, even though it is basically a done deal as far as the pollsters are concerned, although you never know. It's because of the fact of how negative it became towards the end, how it all became wrapped up with trying to portray Susan Hall, his Tory challenger, as basically far-right adjacent. As you say, this suggestion from Wes Streeting, the Shadow Health Secretary, that any vote for the Conservatives is a vote for the far right, for white supremacists. I think that's really scuppered his newfound reputation as a more reasonable, less unhinged member of the Labour front bench. That kind of lies in tatters after that particular tweet. And also that exchange that we saw on LBC recently with the debate between Khan and Hall, where not only is he giving vent to this absurd kind of self-victimising claim that her, when she was a councillor, her liking some spicy right-wing tweets means that it poses a kind of almost physical threat to him at this point, and that he's terribly scared of her. I think while she was trying to talk about his actual record, I think kind of summed up the whole race in a lot of ways in terms of the ridiculousness of it, but also the way in which culture war talking points from the centre-left are just used to distract from their obvious failings.
Yeah, and it seems that, you know, Khan is not someone who's prepared to talk about his record very much, particularly on knife crime. I mean, we've got a clip here that we can show.
Go out on the streets at night time and see about the gangs running around with machetes, because that's the stories I am hearing.
I think the Tory candidate should stop watching The Wire.
I mean, Jake, what do you make of that? I mean, he recorded that not long before, you know, we had this horrific stabbing, you know, murder of a child in Hainault this week. You know, obviously knife crime is a problem in this city. I think it's gone up by 20%. Why is Sadiq Khan so sort of arrogant?
Well, arrogance is precisely the word, that kind of complete sense of detachment from the things that kind of really do worry people who live or work in London, which is the kind of slow deterioration of the social fabric in London and the rise of these awful attacks and the kind of gang violence and all the rest of it. And for him to, it bespeaks that arrogance that every time somebody kind of raises the comment, they must either be a far right person or a fantasist or whatever. And this constant, as you put it, Tom, the way it became negative as the race went on, speaks to they haven't got anything to stand on in terms of the record. Everything under London reminding a little bit like that Michelle Welbeck quote that we mentioned before the show started. It's like everything is the same as before, just a little bit worse. That's basically kind of Sadiq Khan's legacy to London. And instead of grappling with that, confronting it, and speaking to these things that really worry people who live and work in London, it's instead you're either a racist far-right person or you're just a fantasist who watches too much TV.
And Tom, I mean, Sadiq Khan might not be concerned about knife crime or, you know, the state of public transport or any of those things that Londoners care about, but he is very upset if we're, you know, too banterous, if we crack jokes potentially that might have a slightly sexist undertone.
Are you talking about the May campaign?
I am, yes.
I absolutely love that, because that's him summed up, isn't it? You've got all of these huge problems that London is facing, all of the terrible things which have gone on under his watch. I mean, knife crime was falling in the early 2010s, and then it kind of shoots up under his premiership, goes down again because of the pandemic, as violent crime was wont to do, but it's going back up again. You've got the problem of even something like nightlife in London. You know, yeah, we had his famous night czar who has presided over the complete degradation of London's nightlife.
And she's on a six-figure salary as well.
Exactly, the only person in that sector who's doing well at the moment, it seems. So I think what you really see with Khan is the fact, and you see it in a lot of places, a lot of other kind of Western or American cities where you've got the centre-left party, which is just sort of so in control, where you have the fabric of kind of city life just fraying everywhere. But what the thin gruel that you're offered, to mix my metaphors, is that you should, is values, is this vague sense of, but you're on the side of diversity, you're on the side of goodness, you're on the side of people who will tell their friend not to aggressively flirt with someone. Mm. You're on the side of a mayor of London who will trumpet their commitment to LGBT values at every opportunity, including a fireworks display on New Year's Eve. And it's just one of those things where, obviously, for the moment, the Labour Party seems really difficult to displace in London, but that's not going to hold forever because of the fact that people aren't going to put up with virtue signalling at the expense of not just living standards and quality of life, but people's lives at certain points. But that's all they've got, I think. They kind of know that they are incapable of tackling the big issues, so they'll just indulge in this theatre.
And finally, probably one of the most hated Khan policies has been the expansion of ULEZ, certainly in the most recent term. I mean, doesn't that just sort of go to show that, you know, he sort of poses as this son of a bus driver from Tooting, but really doesn't actually give a damn about the lives of ordinary working class people?
Yeah, for sure. The ULEZ is another great example alongside the knife crime issue. And it is interesting to note that lots of the independent standing are kind of slightly interesting or wacky collection of people, as they often are, although some interesting people too. But a lot of them, it's ULEZ. It's like ULEZ that's really motivated them. And obviously, it takes something to stand for Mayor of London, even if you're very much a fringe candidate. But that ULEZ issue has got a really wide appeal in a way, maybe because it affects maybe more people who commute into London as well as people who live there. It's not going to be the kind of election deciding issue, but it's really emblematic of the way that, right, it's woke policy, net zero at all costs. If you, the ordinary people, will kind of pay the price for that, and the people to be talked down to and told how to live and drive and commute.
And the ULEZ thing definitely really speaks to the class component of all of this. Like, what London does Sadiq Khan really represent? I mean, going into the election, depending on which pollster you look at, you might have a 10-point lead if you look at Savanta, or he's got a 20-point lead if you look at YouGov. But, and this happened at the last mayoral election as well, when he was up against Sean Bailey, is that if you look at the kind of class breakdown of like a YouGov poll, he's basically, despite Labour being so hegemonic in London, amongst working class voters, about neck and neck, which I think is really telling about what constituency he's actually really speaking to.
Yeah.
The people who things like ULEZ doesn't bother them because they just associate it with, you know, an easier cycle into work at their graphic design job. But for people who actually still need to drive and deliver things and do the things that keep the city running, they are not enthusiastic for this agenda, even if they're clearly not enthusiastic for any of the alternatives at this point.
So Scottish First Minister Hamza Yousaf tendered his resignation this week. I mean, he's still staying on until a replacement can be found. I mean, Tom, has the bungling finally caught up with him? Is this the bigger problem with the SNP? What have you made of it?
It was like the bungle to end all bungles, really, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because he basically accidentally imploded his own government, which is amazing. Like, he obviously has this reputation for gaffes, for getting things wrong, falling off knee scooters, all of that we went over on the show last week. But for the fact that he terminates this coalition agreement with the Greens, and then he's shocked to find out that they're so upset about it, they might not support his minority government inside Holyrood, was really quite funny. I thought it was interesting that the note on which he went out on, though, in his speech that he gave, where aside from the, it's relatively short, and aside from the usual thank yous to party and family and so on, he made a point of saying that while Scotland's a great country, there's still too much hatred, that politicians have to resist the allure of populism. And I thought it was another kind of fitting epitaph, insofar as not just Yousaf, but the whole SNP project has been so bound up with defining themselves often against the Scottish people, wanting to kind of reform the Scottish people, remake them. And that seems to have been to the extent that it's a legacy, that's the only one that they can point to. It's just, look, we need independence from Westminster so that we can set to work with reprogramming you awful lot.
Yeah.
And I thought that speech was another reminder of that in some way.
Independence from the Scottish people.
Yeah, well, it reminded me a little bit, that closing speech of, I mean, Pedro Sanchez in Spain almost deciding, or wasn't he going to decide, but he eventually decided not to quit under the kind of under this corruption scandal that was growing around his wife. And instead of addressing the corruption scandal, it was all, oh, I'm under so much negative media pressure from the far right, the nasty people. And it was the same, instead of grappling with the issue, you kind of paint the picture of the evil people who are full of hate, as you put it. But the whole debacle was really illustrative of the general state of Scottish politics. A few people have made this point that it's like he was kind of politically raised in an era in which politics doesn't really mean anything in Scotland, and it's kind of virtue signals or kind of social policies that you talked about last week. But the actual job of doing politics, of figuring out where you win the votes, how you get the coalitions together, kind of how you assemble that kind of the mechanics of government, seemed like completely alien to him. And so the idea that you might terminate an agreement and then that might have political repercussions for you, that was just completely alien. Like, it never crossed his mind that this might kind of implode his whole premiership.
And there was a sort of brief, potentially delicious moment, nothing really came of it, where there was the possibility of Ash Regan, who the former SNP leadership candidate, in fact, who went off to join Alba, you know, possibly casting the deciding vote in the future of his premiership. Lyndon Johnson, I think, has said you can't do politics if you can't count. And he obviously just didn't see any of that coming.
Yeah, well, the outcome of it as well has really illustrated your point about them kind of running scared of the Scottish people. So today you've had this kind of weird spectacle of it all getting tied up very quickly in terms of the leadership race. But the overriding concern of everybody involved is there can't be an election.
Yeah.
Absolutely, at no cost must this issue be put to the people. Instead, we're going to handle it in-house. We'll find some kind of continuity candidate, as it seems like it's some old hand who can steady the ship. But at any cost, do not ask the people what they think.
And as awful as the SNP are, basically every political party in Scotland, I guess bar the Tories, has their fingers on every SNP screw up. I mean, you know, the Greens were absolutely insane. Actually campaigning against economic growth while in government, for instance. Mm. But, you know, Labour supported the Hate Crime Act, the Gender Recognition Act, all of the things that have unraveled this project so spectacularly.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think what's interesting, though, is that I don't expect any great public reverse ferrets apologies for supporting some of the really dangerous and authoritarian policies that you've listed there. But at the same time, it is interesting how chastened they've been by this particular experience, and how actually you keep seeing this across the Anglosphere, basically, where you've had one leader after another who's really embraced the sort of mantle of like woke authoritarianism. They wouldn't see it that way. Mm-hmm. They see it as bringing their particular nation, you know, into the 21st century, kicking and screaming. But, you know, Leo Varadkar stepped down, you know, just over, what was it, a month ago. Before that, of course, there was Nicola Sturgeon stepping down, someone who is, very much the kind of embodiment in many respects of a lot of the dreadful politics that we're talking about here. Jacinda Ardern, last year. Justin Trudeau is having a terrible time of it at the moment. I mean, he's like losing in the polls by double digits to the Conservatives there in Canada. So all of these political parties who have engaged in precisely this politics that we're talking about, defining yourself against your own people, introducing sweeping hate crime and hate speech legislation, in basically imposing policies on them, whether it's on migration or transgenderism or whatever, in the face of clear public opposition to it. The environmental issue, you take all of these things together, they've all been pursuing a very similar agenda. And across the piece, really, it's colliding both with reality and with public opinion. And in each of these cases, people haven't been defeated in an election, but they've stepped down because of the fact they realised their authority was shredded amongst the public. That had finally caught up with them. So I think, even though it doesn't always seem like it, there's been some, for those of us who are interested in a more liberal democratic politics, it's actually not been a bad year or so in so far as the punishment beatings that have been inflicted on some of these people.
So let's move on to talk about the the spoiled brats, really, of Columbia University and some of the other elite US universities who are protesting. I want to show a clip of, I think, the archetypal protested.
First of all, we're saying that they're obligated to provide food to students who pay for a meal plan here. I mean, it's crazy to say because we're on an Ivy League campus, but this is like basic humanitarian aid. Like, people please have a glass of water.
So that was Johanna King Slutsky speaking before the police raided the occupation, demanding humanitarian aid. I mean, does she think she's actually living in Gaza or something?
I saw someone say this on Twitter. It's like they're kind of cosplaying as like as oppressed Gazans or something like that. It's ridiculous, but also it's incredibly unseemly. Yeah. I mean, I think that clip is fascinating because of the fact that it really speaks to the entitlement of these protesters, the extent to which they really expect to be indulged, even to the point where, you know, they were occupying this building, Hamilton Hall. They broke their way in. They were barricading the doors. Yeah. You know, this was full-blown occupation, civil disobedience. This wasn't a peaceful protest. And yet they expected the university to provide them with refreshments whilst they were doing
and
so.
And smashing windows as well.
Exactly. Like they were. It was such a bizarre spectacle. But, you know, we've spoken a lot on the last podcast about the rank anti-Semitism, which has been expressed at a lot of these protests at the gates of Columbia, and the really unsettlingly high tolerance that a lot of these protesters have for that anti-Semitism, even if they're not directly engaging in it themselves always. But at the same time, there's this other side to it, which is this babyish desire to be indulged. And I think it does speak to the fact that a lot over the recent years, a lot of these kind of supposed campus radicals have been indulged to a certain extent.
Yeah.
And I think it really came to a head when the NYPD come and clear Hamilton Hall, which is that you saw this reaction, which was almost like it was bizarre, strange, surprising that having mounted this occupation, that might come with certain consequences.
Yeah.
You saw students being interviewed on cable news saying that this is a blow to freedom of speech, as if freedom of speech just gives you free rein to smash windows and so on. And I thought that was really striking. I mean, we've already talked about it before, but there is obviously the free speech question over these protests, particularly in the crackdown that happened at the University of Texas at Austin. Really questionable, illiberal attempt to crack down on peaceful protest. But at the same time, if you're engaging in civil disobedience, you should expect consequences. That's the whole point.
Yeah.
You're breaking the rules, and that's what gives it its power, is that you're supposed to say, I care about this so much that I'm willing to risk arrest. The fact that they were almost surprised to see that forcibly breaking into a university building and smashing things up came with those consequences, I think spoke to that level of sort of upper middle class self-indulgence that these kids have been brought up in. So much so that they expect to be able to engage in not only anti-Semitic conduct, but violent conduct, and basically get a pat on the head for doing so.
Yeah, be on the right side of history, I guess.
Well, I think what puts the, like, really captures the protest is this, like, very strange mix of this complete entitlement, as you say, the anti-Semitic element that you guys discussed last week, and then this, like, really creepy kind of herd-like authoritarianism that they display, that I find to be the one of the signal features of the protest, where they, like, all link arms and, like, autonomons kind of, like, march along, that they all wear masks, cover their faces, they're like, there's no, like, this point you're making about civil disobedience, it involves standing up, taking responsibility for something, saying, look, we're not going to put up with this because we believe it's wrong. That, I think, comes with an expectation that you should actually stand up, that instead of hiding yourself and not saying anything, they all speak in this, like, unison chanting, and there's something really creepy and herd-like that speaks to the fact that this is kind of less a kind of courageous, organized political movement, and more something that people are kind of jammed into and feel that they just have to go along with a particular agenda to some degree. And you put all these ingredients together in the protest, and you get something that, as you say, is very far from being a kind of free speech issue. It's very far from being a kind of principled identification with, if you think of the plight of the Palestinians. It's very far from this. It's instead very much more reflective of the kind of their own coddled nature as students who've never really been challenged properly, and this instinctive kind of self-identification, self-hatred with the place that they're in, with America and the West. And that's that's why the American flag has become almost a flashpoint in these protests, which is that for them, getting rid of the American flag and putting the Palestinian one in its place is, like, the most important. It's the getting rid of the American flag that's the most important bit. The Palestinian thing is almost kind of second to it.
Definitely. And in fact, you know, as you say, you know, the conformism, or the enforced conformism, is really striking. I mean, there's a clip we've got actually of people just not being allowed onto campus if they don't support the protests.
This is what they do. I'm a UCLA student. I deserve to go here. We pay tuition. This is our school. And they're not letting me walk in.
If you don't have the right politics, you're not on the list, basically. Yeah. It's, you know.
Or if you're a Jewish student.
Yeah, if you're Jewish.
I think that was at UCLA, but you're seeing very similar things at various different American universities. And it just rubbishes this idea that that this is free speech that we're talking about in many of these instances. Free speech does not give you a right to commit violence. It doesn't give you a right to harass and discriminate and stop Jewish students from moving around university campuses. This is obvious.
Yeah.
But they've been able to sort of blur this line, I think, just because of the fact that, as has been the case in a lot of American elite higher education for a long time, is that they've been indulged, they've been encouraged, they've been told that they are basically on the right side of history. And I think it's interesting and dispiriting that you've got so many of the kind of older generation of sort of 60s radicals who have been indulging them in that comparison.
Yeah.
So, of course, like Hamilton Hall was occupied in 1968 in opposition to the Vietnam War, but also there was this row over a gymnasium that Columbia were building in Harlem that students alleged was basically going to be de facto segregated.
Yeah.
You know, the only thing that's similar is that they both occupied that building.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of what they were occupying it for, first of all, I don't think those students expected to get a soft hand from the police, no. You know, which is certainly what happened. About 700 of them were arrested.
They wanted some meal, you know, hot meals.
No, exactly. There was no mention of meal plans as far as I can work out from the historical record. But also, what were they protesting about? They were protesting about the war and they were protesting against racism. Whereas what these students are doing is luxuriating in racism, being incredibly tolerant of racism. One character I found out about this week is Kamani James, I think his name is, who was one of the leaders of this protest, was being interviewed by CNN about their demands and so on. But it's been going through a disciplinary process at Columbia because of the fact that he'd put out these videos of himself talking about how Zionists don't deserve to live and kind of fantasizing about getting into a deadly confrontation with them.
He fights to kill, he says.
Really? I mean, he doesn't look like he's ever had a fight in his life. But nevertheless, the fact that he's saying these things and the fact that excuses are being made for them and people who should know better are saying anti-Semitism, what anti-Semitism are you talking about, is chilling.
But I think we have to also get on a bit to the kind of reaction to the protests as well. And I mean, we've seen various different kinds of reactions. You maybe don't support pitch battles between different, between pro and anti protest camps or whatever. Although that is a, when you take the law into your own hands and violate the law, this is you have to kind of expect that maybe people won't take this line down. But in some ways, I think, again, referring to that almost battle over the American flag and that group of fraternity kids who came and kind of stood and made a point of defending the reinsertion of the American flag. I think what the protests represent, maybe they're over now, maybe the police seem to have moved in across a lot of America, but this represents, I think, a bit of an eye-opening moment for lots of Americans that what's going on in Israel and the reaction to it at home is not just about a kind of simple conflict between Israel and Palestine or Israel and Hamas, right? Mm. But what's happened at home, this sense that they really hate everything American, everything Western, that there's this kind of fixation on the Jews as the embodiment of white evil. And that I think happening in America on American campuses has really opened people's eyes to the fact that there is a kind of real culture war, real civilizational battle at play here between those who defend some of the legacies that are associated with America, as imperfect as they might be, and those who kind of completely want to overthrow them, join in, as we saw in kind of mass Islamic prayer rituals, which like fine to pray, but there was something kind of, again, conformist, a bit herd-like, a bit weird about all of that. And that this has been reflected, I think. So Trump has really changed his tune on the Israel conflict over the last few days. You've seen him kind of maybe he said no longer supports a two-state solution. You say that he thinks anti-Semitism is a really massive problem across America, and he's reading the mood music, or he's listening to the mood music, and something has changed in America now, I think, and maybe more broadly, that it's no longer just to say that this is a conflict over there that's kind of got nothing to do with us. There's some real battles closer to home.
And it didn't start with this war either, I think, is also the one, because there's been some kind of critics of campus cancel culture have been looking at this slightly aghast and thinking, you know, just under 10 years ago, we were all laughing at the Yale snowflakes who went into like open revolt because an academic sent around an email saying, maybe you guys should chill out about offensive Halloween costumes.
Yeah.
So we've gone from, you know, babyish offense taking to pro Hamas in the space of 9 years. You know, how has that happened? But I think as a lot of us have been writing about and talking about, is that this is clearly on a kind of continuum. There's clearly a relationship between students who believe that all of the fundamental values of the West are rotten, who believe speech is violence, end up engaging in violence, and have been reared on this identity politics, which has now been kind of applied to geopolitics with depressingly predictable anti-Semitic consequences. So I don't think anyone should be surprised that this has happened. And this is not just a visceral humanitarian reaction to the scenes that they're seeing in the news.
Definitely not. Right, so finally, let's talk about the brewing row between Ireland and the UK. Ireland is essentially blaming Brexit Britain for its migration crisis, in particular the Rwanda policy. Now, the Irish Justice Minister quite infamously claimed, Helen McEntee, their name is, that 80% of the migrants in Ireland have come directly from the UK and are being sort of encouraged to come here surreptitiously. I mean, Jacob, what have you made of this? I mean, is this just sort of buck passing from the Irish government?
Well, it comes at the same time as a kind of popular discontent in Ireland around the immigration issue is really, and especially the asylum issue, is really, really beginning to grow and maybe even get a little bit out of control in some places. And we saw the riots or the protests a little while ago now, but now lots more videos are cropping up, people confronting even builders, as one viral video had it, of who were said to be converting a hotel into a place to house asylum seekers. And so it's like there's this groundswell of feeling that the Irish people are being kind of given a very bad bargain by their leaders. And then they've got no answer to this. Mm. They're completely constrained within all of the kind of processes and procedures of the EU. So they're not going to change anything. They probably can't, even if they wanted to. And so instead, it's kind of convenient. Let's return to the old enemy. Oh, it must be the kind of the British who are at fault. And I think it probably doesn't take a genius to realize that it's not everybody who comes in to London to like try and start a new life or be an asylum seeker or something, or coming through Dover, has suddenly decided to go to Northern Ireland and go down. It's like it seems it's much less likely that that's the case than they found a scapegoat for an issue that they don't have any answers to.
Yeah, definitely. Tom, what have you made of?
No, I think it's been interesting how with this story, it's just that whole narrative that the Irish political class have been trying to spin in recent years, very much defining themselves against Brexit Britain, that we're this wayward, populist, horrendous, anti-migrant place. And how in this story, it's just kind of unraveled all of that. So obviously there's the point about there's many kind of Irish political leaders spent a lot of time talking about the Rwanda policy and how this proved that the Tory government is rotten and so on. They're now in the process of trying to challenge, trying to change the law because their own courts have said that you cannot deport migrants to Britain because it's an unsafe country.
Yeah.
So they're now having to kind of reverse ferret on that. There's obviously the whole border question. Varadkar in particular, now departed, was very central in the EU's weaponization of the border issue to try and bring Britain to heel in the negotiations. Now they were sending police up to go and monitor the border. It's been kind of walked back a bit. They're trying to pretend they're not doing it, but that's really interesting. So on immigration, on the border, it's just all unraveled so suddenly.
It's hilarious. Because they were basically saying during the Brexit arguments that if you have a single customs check, you know, if you check some milk, pass it, or some cheese passing from Northern Ireland to the Republic of Ireland, there will be, you know, the IRA will be back. They'll be firebombing the customs borders. And now they've sent the actual police down to the border to stop, you know, to stop people moving back and forth, something which, you know, even a different Brexit deal would never have proposed.
Yeah, well, it really bespeaks the fact that this is them casting around for some kind of external solution to what is a kind of a homegrown, or at least a problem that comes with being part of the European Union and with all the border problems that we know we have, and that sense that something that is very representative of the kind of cultural elites and the political elites who govern large parts of the West, that something that could seem like a sacred cow a few months ago or a couple of years ago can suddenly just be dropped overnight.
Yeah.
And you've got a complete, because the political imperative demands it. And that as much as anything is what really grates, I think, with people who are watching this as almost as spectators, that hang on, you told us one minute this was the most important issue in the world. And now, as you know, we'll have police on the border. Why not?
and Tom, funny, I mean, is it, I guess, could you say it's sort of unraveling of virtue signaling? Because there's nothing wrong with inviting lots of, you know, refugees over to Ireland or to the UK or whatever. But you kind of need to have a plan for how to deal with it.
And you need to do it with the consent of the people who already live there. I mean, that's the one thing that I think Ireland has become just a slightly more extreme version of, is that for the technocratic political class, immigration has sort of served two purposes, neither of which have much to do with migrants themselves. One of which is virtue signaling, as you say. It's how you send a message about that Ireland is a modern, progressive, diverse nation.
Land of 1,000 welcomes.
Exactly. All of that stuff, not so welcoming at the moment, as it turns out, because people are not happy about this issue. But you use it for the kind of purposes of making a statement about yourself as a nation. You also can use it quite cynically, and we've seen that across the piece, of a way to, you know, plug gaps in skills and, you know, employment and address
wages,
exactly, address those kinds of issues and just try and kind of mask issues in the economy by artificially inflating GDP figures and stuff like that. So there's that element to it as well. All at the same time is not making any provision whatsoever for the people that are coming in, whether that's in terms of integration, whether that's in terms of housing. Ireland has a really chronic housing issue, which is leading to a lot of their kind of young people who just decide that they have to get up and leave if they want to be able to get on in life. And you're just so struck by how this is obviously infuriating the Irish citizenry, who were never asked their view on any of this.
Yeah.
And now there seems to be a concerted attempt to clamp down their ability to even talk about it in the form of their own hate crime bill, which is kind of slightly on ice at the moment. And obviously it doesn't help the people who you've basically sort of given a green light to. You've given a strong signal that they should come and claim asylum or become a migrant in your country. And yet there is no genuine provision for them, so much so that you've got tent cities popping up in the middle of Dublin.
Yeah.
So it's definitely the unravelling of all of that virtue signalling, all of that cant. But you can only hope that at this point it's not something that is just papered over again, that there's actually a proper democratic debate about this and how to get out of it, not just in Ireland, but in many of these countries.
Thank you so much for watching the Spikes podcast. We'll be back next Friday. If you hit subscribe and click the bell, you'll never miss an episode. And in the meantime, why not check out all of Spikes' other videos and podcasts on this channel? And for more Spiked content, find us at spiked-online.com.